After the triple meltdown of reactors in Fukushima, Japan in March 2011, the American Nuclear Regulatory Commission did two things. They assured the public it can't happen here, and they promised a flurry of action to make reactors safer in the United States. Now we have the first new book from nuclear experts explaining what happened at Fukushima. And we have a report that nuclear reactors are still unsafe, maybe still waiting for the next major meltdown. Both come from David Lochbaum. He's worked in the U.S. reactors for 17 years. He was an instructor for the NRC. David is now director of the Nuclear Safety Project for the Union of Concerned Scientists. David Lochbaum, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex, for having me on again.
There's just so much to talk about. Before I get distracted by a long list of questions about American reactor safety, why don't we start with your new book as co-author of Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster. How would you describe it to people?
We undertook the book with two purposes. One, to try to explain to a general audience what happened at Fukushima. It was a very gripping drama as the event unfolded, but it took some time for some of the government and other studies to try to go in there and figure out why things happened. So we tried to look at that record, do some research, and present what happened in a way that would be appealing to a broader audience than just the science folks out there. The second part of the reason for doing the book was to extract as many lessons learned from the disaster as possible so they can be implemented here in the United States to make it less likely that any of our reactors goes down that same pathway.
Has a book come out in Japan about this accident that you know about? And given the new secrecy laws, could it even come out?
Well, I know Arne Gunderson, a colleague of mine at Fairwinds, authored a book that was translated in Japan and came out about this time last year. So I know that book, they also made a tour through Japan in a number of places to talk about the book. The word is getting out. It was a big disaster, and it's as relevant there as it is here.
Have you had any reaction from Japan about your new book?
Not so far. We've not yet had an edition translated into Japan. I have heard from some Japanese reporters who've read it. There's a few things they're still trying to track down. For example, there's a lot of rumors about the earthquake causing more damage than had the company or others are admitting. So there's some people want to track down some of those details yet.
Okay, well, to my mind, there are three major scenes in this Fukushima tragedy. The opening act is the decades where the risks could have been known and weren't dealt with. And then we have the technical story of what happened in nuclear terms. And maybe the saddest part, the failure of humans to react properly and rationally, which is maybe understandable. But let's start at the beginning. Should the Japanese have known this could happen, and could they have done more to prevent part of their country from being laced with radiation?
Well, the Japanese knew that plant was in an area where the earthquake hazard was pretty high. They had designed the plant to withstand a 9.0 earthquake and kind of understood or recognized that an earthquake of even lesser magnitude than 9.0 could cause the plant to lose its normal supply of electricity, the off-site power grid. Recognizing that, they had designed the plant to have each of the reactors at Fukushima to have two emergency diesel generators at the site, only one of which needed to survive in order to provide power for the equipment needed to cool the reactor core. To better protect those emergency diesel generators from earthquakes, they put all of them down in the basement of the plants where they're best shielded or protected against ground motions caused by an earthquake. They also knew that because it was a coastal plant, that tsunamis could be a problem. They built a 15-foot tall seawall around the plant. As late as 2008, people had raised questions that given a 9.0 earthquake just offshore, that the tsunami wave height could be as high as 45 feet. Knowing that the seawall was only 15 feet tall and the hazard might be 45 feet tall, unfortunately, the company and the regulator said the chances of that occurring was so small as to not even worry about. On March 11, 2011, the tsunami wave that arrived was about 45 feet tall, proving the predictions right and proving the protections inadequate. The floodwaters got into the basement and caused all the emergency diesel generators to be disabled due to submergence. Had they fully recognized both the earthquake and the flooding hazards, they might have taken steps to employ diversity. Rather than put all the emergency diesel generators in the same place where they're best protected against earthquake but least protected against flooding, they might have put some up high and some down low, making it harder for the 1-2 punch to take everything off the table. So they had some opportunities, and they're actually taking those steps at the surviving plants now to build taller seawalls and implement some diversity, but it's a little bit too late for Fukushima.
Do we know where that nuclear fuel is now and what condition it's in?
No, we don't know where the three reactor cores are. Well, we have general proximity. They're somewhere inside containment, but we're not exactly sure whether the molten cores melted through the metal reactor vessels that surround them and got onto the containment floors. The Japanese have been trying to use remote indications to send in fiber optic cables. They've even floated remote-controlled boats on the water and even some remote-powered drones inside containment to try to get pictures of the situation in there. But so far, they've had various complications and still haven't yet found where the reactor cores ended up.
Is there any visible end to the process of trying to cool those reactors and handle all that radioactive water?
There is a visible end, but it's way, way down the road. It's probably 3-4 decades before they reach that destination. The good news is that they're making progress along that path. The bad news is it's a very long path, but they are making progress. To give them credit, things are much better off today than they were 2 or 3 years ago.
And they're starting to get the reactor fuel out of the fuel pool in Reactor 4. That's some good news to start with.
That's very good news. First of all, they went in 2011 and early 2012 and provided additional bracing for the building that housing the spent fuel pool that was damaged initially by the earthquake, then by the hydrogen explosion, and then by tons of water that were dumped from above. So they provided some concrete and iron bracing so that the additional aftershocks removing the fuel wouldn't cause the building to collapse. Then they moved out some heavy loads that were not radioactive, like the reactor vessel head and the drywall head, that demonstrated that they could lift heavy objects off of the floor and not cause collapse or further problems. Then they moved the new fuel that had not yet been irradiated, was not yet dangerous, out of the pool to again demonstrate that the process would work and build up confidence. And then last November, they began moving spent fuel out of the pool. So they're moving in an orderly, deliberate fashion to make things better without any backsteps or sidesteps.
Well, I'd like to see American reactor operators doing that all over the country, but we'll get to that. I know there's a problem with overloading of American fuel pools. Now, look, David, when we look at Japan as outsiders, it's very difficult to fathom what's going on there, even in normal times. From the viewpoint of a nuclear expert, do you think American companies and governments could have done any better in the same situation?
No. I think had any of our reactors been faced with that kind of challenge, the outcome would have been the same. The timeline might have been different. It might have taken a little bit shorter or a little bit longer at different places, or the pathway might have been a little bit different, but the destination would have been the same. The Fukushima plant technology was very similar to ours, and the regulations were, you know, a little bit better in some places, a little bit worse in some place, but not significantly different that would have caused our reactors to fare any differently. About the only difference between U.S. reactors and Japanese reactors was that we had done more after 9/11 to provide better protection against suicide aircraft than the Japanese had. Our plants had more portable pumps and more portable generators, but at the same token, we had added those resources with the suicide aircraft in mind. Much of that equipment was stored in buildings that wouldn't survive an earthquake or wouldn't survive a hurricane or some other natural disaster. So they would survive a suicide aircraft, but not acts of nature. So we, even though we were somewhat better prepared, we still have a way to go.
So you and the Union of Concerned Scientists just released a report on safety in nuclear reactors in America, and an amazing number of atomic power plants don't even meet the fire codes. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that all dates back to March 22, 1975, when a worker using a lit candle to check for air leaks started a fire in a room right below the control room for the Unit 1 and Unit 2 reactors at the Browns Ferry nuclear plant in Alabama. All the cables for the controlled equipment or powered equipment throughout the building went from the control room down through the floor and then radiated out through the plant through this room. The fire burned for 7 hours and basically disabled all of the controls and systems for cooling the Unit 1 reactor and the majority of those systems for the Unit 2 reactor. It was only some very heroic worker actions that day that prevented both reactors from melting down. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission in 1980 adopted regulations seeking to better manage the fire risk so that none of our reactors would come that close to, or worse, a problem in the future. In the mid-90s, the NRC found that most reactors did not meet those regulations, including the three reactors at Browns Ferry. So in 2004, the NRC adopted a second set of regulations. So now owners have choice of either meeting the 1980 regulations or meeting the 2004 regulations. But today, roughly half the plants in the country, it's like 49 out of 100 reactors currently operating in the United States, don't meet either set of regulations. It's not an academic point. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission senior managers have testified to their commission that fire represents 50% of the threat of core damage at the typical U.S. nuclear power plant, which means it's equal to all the other hazards combined. The reason the hazard is so high is for the same reasons that Fukushima had problems. In that case, water flooded the systems, shorted out the electrical equipment, and prevented all the dozens of pumps from working. Fire poses the same threat. A single fire can disable primary safety systems and their backups, such that workers have no options left for preventing core damage.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking about the Fukushima nuclear accident and its lessons for safety in American nuclear plants. My guest is the author of a new book about it. David Lochbaum is with the Union of Concerned Scientists. Dave, in late June 2011, the Fort Calhoun nuclear reactor was surrounded by the floodwaters of the Missouri River. Why was that dangerous?
That was dangerous because the floodwaters could have caused the normal supply of power, the electrical transmission, the offsite power grid, power lines, everything, to fail. At the same time, it could flood the on-site backups, the emergency diesel generators, just as happened at Fukushima, where the earthquake and tsunami took out those two layers of power. Fort Calhoun was faced with a flooding that posed the same risk. The good news about Fort Calhoun was that the prior year, in the fall of 2010, the NRC's inspectors found that flood protection was not adequate at that plant. The owner protested, saying the plant had been operating for 30 years and therefore it must be good enough. But the NRC listened to those arguments and rejected them and made the owner take steps to better protect that plant against postulated flooding. Those measures came in real handy in June of 2011 when the plant literally became an island in the Missouri River. And while the plant was shut down for more than 2 years, the things could have been much, much worse had not the NRC found and caused those problems to be fixed in advance.
And there's a bunch of other nuclear plants that have no plan to deal with the dam breaking upstream. Is that true?
That's true. In fact, there's 34 reactors that are like Fort Calhoun that are vulnerable to flooding. There's actually one plant in the country that's vulnerable to a downstream dam failing because that dam provides the lake from which it draws its cooling water. And if that dam were to fail, the lake becomes a mud flat and the plant doesn't have any cooling water supply anymore. So there are 35 reactors in the United States that are vulnerable to flooding, and the NRC's actually known about that since before Fukushima, since as early as 2007. But none of those plants are yet protected.
And this is something that puzzles me and it confuses the public. A nuclear reactor produces huge amounts of power, but if outside electricity is cut off, even for short periods, the whole system risks blowing up or melting down. Why can't a reactor use its own power to run the cooling system, the water intakes, and all that?
It could. Nuclear power plants could be self-powering, but in order to do that, the equipment used to make electricity and distribute it within a plant would have to be safety-related. It means it would have to survive the earthquake or the fire or whatever hazard it's faced. Nuclear power plants have highly reliable, high-quality equipment for cooling the reactor cores. They do not have that same equipment for making electricity. That's basically industrial grade. In order to upgrade the equipment to safety-related in the buildings that house it, since they could collapse in case of an earthquake, owners would have to spend much, much more money. So rather than do that, they don't rely on that equipment. They don't allow the plants, or they don't equip the plants to power themselves. Instead, they rely on two emergency diesel generators to provide the subset of equipment needed to cool the reactor cores. That philosophy works as long as the emergency diesel generators survive.
And they have battery backup for a few hours, 4 hours in some cases, and 8 hours in others. That seems so pitifully little. Why don't they get some batteries in there that could really keep it going until, as you put it, the cavalry can arrive?
That was based on looking backwards. We looked backwards at how long power outages have lasted, either due to the grid or the emergency diesel generators. And it was generally thought that either 4 hours or 8 hours would be sufficient time to reconnect to the grid or fix the broken diesel generators and and the need to rely on the batteries. Part of it was also just short-sightedness, which in hindsight is hard to explain, but it happened anyway. Fukushima and our plants were all built under the assumption that an accident would only involve one reactor. Fukushima had six reactors sitting side by side by side, but it was only thought that one reactor would have a problem, so that you could use the electricity generated from its neighbor to power the unit that was having an accident. You know, when you have an earthquake and tsunami that puts all six reactors in jeopardy, we had just never anticipated that. Neither the Japanese nor we had done that. In hindsight, again, that wasn't our brightest day, but that's the way it was.
Well, that sort of outlines another big problem with American nuclear power and nuclear power in general, that the licenses and oversight don't include the risks beyond a limited mode of thinking. Would you agree with that?
Yes, to extent. We basically, in fact, our book talks about the X, we design for X, but nobody ever answers the question, what if X plus 1 occurs? And that speaks to that issue. Fukushima and our reactors are designed for only a certain range of hazard. We just don't anticipate anything larger than that will happen. If something larger does happen, we rely on miracles to occur, or we rely on, we'll just get people out of the way. We'll evacuate or shelter people from the radioactive cloud so that no one will be harmed. Again, those emergency plans are predicated on the accident occurring on a nice sunny day where there's no damage to roads or any other problems getting people out of harm's way. I think Fukushima showed that everybody needs to do a better job of planning for the very severe accidents rather than just hoping they don't occur or that a miracle occurs to get them out of it.
On Radio Ikushuk, I recently covered hearings where the NRC sought a generic environmental approval process for all nuclear reactors instead of case by case, and that followed a high court ruling, I believe. What happened to that?
That's still a work in progress. The ruling was, what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission had ruled was that spent fuel generated by our plants could safely remain on site until a geological repository opened and was able to take that fuel. The court ruled that the NRC had not satisfied all the bases necessary for that decision. For one thing, it was open-ended. They didn't look, well, what if a repository is never available and so on. So the Nuclear Regulatory Commission undertook a proceeding to look at the issue from a generic standpoint, saying that all of our plants, all the spent fuel generated by our plants, could remain at the plant site for over a century after the plant shuts down and still be safe. That seems some more science fiction than science, but we'll let the courts decide.
And it seems like nuclear reactors almost never die in America. There have been some cases, but they're few. And no matter how old the concrete and the pipes, they seem to get an automatic license renewal, even for another 60 years beyond their design capabilities. Why is that happening?
Well, there have been some reactors that shut down. In 2013, four reactors in the United States shut down due to mainly economic reasons. But as you point out, more than three-quarters of the plants operating in the United States have sought and obtained license extensions. In some cases, to be fair to the NRC, they've ultimately said yes, but along the way they said no until the owner did more to satisfy the agency. So it's not quite a rubber stamp, although they've never denied one. They've said no, not yet, quite a bit. We've looked at license renewal or aging of nuclear power plants and compared it to two people who buy identical cars off the same lot on the same day. If the owner of the first vehicle doesn't change the oil, doesn't do any of the preventative maintenance that the owner's manual dictates, while the owner of the second car does all those preventative maintenance tasks, those two cars will likely be in different shapes down the road. The person who does the proper care will have a better car than the other owner. And we point out that U.S. nuclear plants are similar, and that if you don't do maintenance properly, you can get in trouble well before your license extends or ends. And if you do the maintenance properly, you can also extend, ensure safety margins are maintained and allow your plant to operate longer. So we've been focusing on making sure that the safety margins are known and adequate rather than just look at the calendar and say some artificial date is the right answer.
David Lochbaum, getting back to your book, Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster, we learned the meltdown was made worse, likely by a flaw design in General Electric Mark I reactors. Tell us why that model could be more dangerous in an accident.
The containment that Fukushima had featured what is called a pressure suppression containment. in order to minimize the size of the containment and therefore reduce the cost for the amount of concrete needed to make the containment, that reactor design used a large body of water, more than 2 million gallons of water, housed inside containment. That water functioned essentially like an energy sponge to absorb the energy lost in case of an accident. The problem with that was that if the accident ever did occur and you weren't able to cool that body of water, because that energy sponge at some point becomes saturated and cannot absorb any more energy, they had no measure for cooling, you know, emptying that energy sponge so it could absorb more energy. As a result, they tried to do some actions to get around that problem, but it meant sending workers into darkened areas that had 18 inches of water on the floor, open manholes, and high radiation levels. The workers weren't able to take the steps necessary to work around that problem in time to prevent three reactor cores from melting down. It wasn't that they failed. They were given so many traps that it was very unlikely they could succeed against those challenges. The system that they were given, which is the same as our plants are given, works if you have power. The most likely scenario for you to get into trouble is if you don't have power, and that's been recognized since the 1980s. So we've given people a solution that really no one expects to work. And yet we based operation on that myth.
How many of those Mark I reactors are still operating in the United States?
There are 23 that are very similar to the units 1, 2, and 3 at Fukushima. But to be fair to the General Electric and the owners of those plants, had any of the U.S. reactors of any design been faced with that challenge, they all would have melted down. So that design contributed to the outcome at Fukushima, but it wasn't the deciding factor.
All right. Now, after Fukushima, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission promised to be more vigilant and get more problems fixed in American reactors. Gregory Jasko was the NRC chair, and he wanted some changes, but then he was kind of booted out, it seems to me. What happened there, and is the NRC really fixed?
Chairman Jasko was very adamant about implementing the lessons learned from Fukushima, and things weren't happening as fast as he would have liked. His fellow commissioners were more accommodating or more leisurely in their pace of the reforms. That led to friction or added to friction that existed between them, and they basically voted him off the island, so he resigned. The NRC has ordered owners to take steps to reduce the vulnerabilities of their plants to the Fukushima-type challenges. Some of those orders have already been issued. There are some other recommendations that are still being evaluated for possible implementation. None of those recommendations is fully implemented at any site yet. The deadline was December 31st of 2016. In monitoring progress so far, 20% of the plants are behind schedule, so it's not boding well that they'll be done in time. It's in an odd situation. First of all, safety IOUs protect no one. It's only deeds that are done that provide protection. And the industry and the NRC are pretty much in a bad position. If an accident does occur that one of these IOUs would have avoided, they're basically be following the same path that Japan did. None of the reactors, nuclear reactors in Japan, are operating today because the civilians have lost trust in the companies and the government and do not allow the reactors to operate. So we're basically taking a huge gamble here, both with people's safety and politically, that an accident won't occur until we get all these fixes implemented.
Yeah, even with the economy. I mean, if 20% of America's power supply that comes from nuclear power was shut down by public demand or public fear, the economy, I don't think, could take the shock.
Yeah, but the flip side of that is the cost of Fukushima is estimated to be over $120 billion. So one bad day at a nuclear power plant can wipe out decades of good days. There's not many other technologies that have that risk-reward ratio.
True. Now, in testimony relating to the C10 group in Boston and the Pilgrim reactor relicensing, you explained that the NRC became much more lax about enforcing regulations after Congress threatened to cut that agency's funding. What is the status of that now?
That's pretty much still in place. That happened back on June 4th of 1998 when the Senate threatened to cut the NRC's budget by about $400 million, which would have, among other things, meant about 500 NRC employees would have been laid off. To avoid that slashing, the NRC agreed to stop enforcing its regulations, and that continues to this day. When Chairman Jasko tried to enforce some of the safety regulations, they got rid of him rather than do that. So it's the NRC tries to regulate, and It did at Fort Calhoun. As I pointed out, in fall of 2002, it solved a problem and took steps to fix it, but they've been unable to enforce the fire protection regulations because the industry is just too much power. Congress has too much say over asking the NRC not to do its job.
Well, one wonders why Congress doesn't want to protect the American public from an obvious risk, and it comes back perhaps to campaign donations. Has anybody written a report or a book about the incestuous links between American political parties and nuclear industry donations?
Public Citizen's Critical Mass Energy Project did studies like that as recently as 3-4 years. Actually, it was before Fukushima, so it would have been 4 or 5 years ago. And at that time, the nuclear industry ranked fourth on the list behind the American Medical Association, the AARP, and I forget who was third. I think it was the tobacco industry. But the nuclear industry gives, they're quite liberal. They pay about equal amounts to Democrats and Republicans. It's not one-sided. They're largesse.
We'll buy everybody. You know, we have to wrap it up there, David. We're running out of time. Our guest has been David Lochbaum. He's worked in the American nuclear plants for 17 years. He's been an instructor at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Now David is director of the Nuclear Safety Project. For an outfit I've been respecting for years, the Union of Concerned Scientists. David's new book is out. He's co-author with Susan Stranahan and a fellow UCS member, Edwin Lyman. And it's called Fukushima, the Story of a Nuclear Disaster. It's the first authoritative look at that disaster with lessons, and we all need to learn them. David, thank you for being so brave to speak out for all of our safety. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Alex, for having me on again. I appreciate it.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShot.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.